time moves both quickly and slowly. That is, time moves in a flash, but much gets accomplished that we can hardly even imagine, and much can happen in our lives that we can hardly imagine in a short period. And I was thinking about these things because our guest, Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine, poet, author, and essayist, and a person with many interesting future plans and developments coming up, has been with poetry and in Chicago now for just about an even decade, about 10 years. And during that time, so much has happened for Chris and to Chris, and he has done so much with his own career and with poetry, with the magazine. And time has flown by since our last interview, which was shortly after Chris came to Chicago, and we had hoped, I think, to do things on at least an annual basis, but it hasn't happened. We did talk with him at various times when some of the wonderful choices that he and his colleagues at the Poetry Foundation made for winners of the Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize each year. But it's a great pleasure to have Chris Wyman back in the WFMT studios to give us an update on some of the projects he's been doing and on where he's going to be going, because he's going to be leaving Chicago halfway through this year at the end of June and taking up a position on the East Coast in a place now buried under snow on July 1st. Chris Wyman, welcome back to WFMT.
Thanks for having me, Andrew. It's good to see you. Thanks for having me here again.
Absolutely. You have been editor of this wonderful little magazine for 10 years now, and there are things about it that have changed a great deal that are, I would say, mostly very good things, and there are things about it that have not changed at all. And I think all of the things that have not changed are good things. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
I hope that's true. I was certainly conscious of wanting to shake up the magazine in some way when I took over and do some different things and yet preserve its history and have a kind of respect for the tradition of the magazine.
And that tradition is a very interesting combination of, on the one hand, a certain kind of basic presentation, small size. On the other hand, finding the next people that people should read, and yet mixing them in a way that, unless you've got the index or the contributors list and find that asterisk or whatever for the new contributor, it's not as if you have a new kid's corner or something
right,
like that. There's some basic.
It's very democratic.
Respect. Yeah, democratic.
It's I mean, the only rules you've got to, only rule for getting in is you got to be good.
Yeah.
And yeah, we do keep an eye out for young poets. I feel like that's the main job of the editor. I mean, it's not. There's a lot of other things that you have to do, but that still remains the main job. It's to keep an eye out for young poets, and I mean, it's tough being a poet in this culture, and I remember, you know, going 10 years trying to get my first book published and just desperate for some kind of response out there. And so one of the real pleasures of the job is that you get to give people that response. And now that we have the foundation behind us, it's quite a large response. Sometimes you can, you know, really promote their work in ways that Poetry Magazine couldn't in the past.
You were brought on by your predecessor, Joe Parisi.
Right. Yeah.
And soon after that, you found out there was going to be more money behind the job. Is that, do I
no,
have the
I
sequence
knew
right?
When,
or you knew when you were when
I
you were
knew.
Being hired?
I okay. knew. I was there the night they announced the gift. I was there, just coincidentally, at the Arts Club when they announced that they had received this. I don't remember what they were saying. I think they were saying it was $100 million at the time. It turned out to be $200 million. So yeah, I was there that night. And then they approached me later, Joe did. And a couple of board members about becoming the editor. I don't remember exactly when, but a few months after that.
And of course, after that, then Joe moved on and initially to head that new foundation, and then moved on, and the board has changed, and John Barr has led the foundation, built things up, literally built a building,
right,
a very handsome building. What's it like to work in that building?
Oh, it's a beautiful place to work. I mean, it's just filled with light, and it's a very calming sort of atmosphere. Mm-hmm. That's what everyone notices when they come in there. It's very calming. And right now we have a revolving exhibition space down at the bottom of the building. Right now we have an unbelievable painting by Joan Mitchell,
right,
which corresponds with the portfolio we did this month. And we've had some great stuff move through there, from small press exhibits to now this big, for us, it's a big production to bring this painting in. And
you know, we'll come back to Joan Mitchell. There's some wonderful Chicago and Poetry Magazine connections there, as well as, of course, her work as an adult, as a fine artist. John Ronan is a wonderful architect and somebody who starts, I think, from what he's doing instead of starting from him, which is what a lot of architects do. Some of the greatest architects, of course, did that. But his work, whether it's the stuff he's done on the South Side for the Comer Youth Centers, or whether it's poetry, I think there's a real sense of, well, what do you all need? Here's some ideas. And at some point, obviously, he does his art in doing that. But especially the location is kind of odd. I mean, that's not any location maybe is odd for, unless it's Emily Dickinson's house or something,
right,
for
yeah,
a poetry home. But as you say, you step in there and you're in both an inner and outer courtyard, and you're in a calming space.
Yeah, I think you're right about John. He does have the capacity, I think, to really inhabit other people's visions without compromising his own at all. His own, you feel that the building is an expression of his vision, but it also expresses the whole history of the magazine.
Right.
And he did it's a phenomenal job that he did there. And one of the things that I like about the building best is you come down and there are people, we'll come downstairs and there'll be people sitting in the library reading just from off the street. And when the weather's nice, we put tables out in the courtyard and there are people having their lunch out there. And
the fact that the library is right there and that it's open and that it's visually open is a wonderful statement. And obviously that's something that must have come from you all as well as from the architect.
And it's enabled us to connect with the community in ways, the entire community of Chicago, in ways that we haven't been able to in the past. For instance, we now have a monthly reading group based around the magazine. So when the magazine comes out each month, in fact, it's today, anyone who wants to in Chicago can come to our building. You got to sign up, but it's free, and we'll give you lunch. And you come and talk about that issue of the magazine, that month's issue of the magazine. And you don't have to be a subscriber. You don't have to read it in advance. It's not homework. You can just show up and talk.
Yeah.
And so
about how many people come?
It varies. You know, we get anywhere from 12 to 40. So it's a good group, and it's like, you know, it's like a seminar for adults. It's just a great chance for literary people, and even some people who are just, you know, incidentally interested in literature to come together and talk. And that's actually my favorite. Those are my favorite kinds of literary conversations, where you get people from all different areas of life, different professions, and get them responding to poems.
We're going to be talking in the next weeks as well with John Barr, who's also stepping down as head of the foundation, and we'll be talking with Robert Polito, who will be what looks to be a very interesting successor. But when the gift was announced and when the size of it was realized, there was a lot of legitimate concern, both on the part of public and observers, but also I know within the magazine and the foundation, what would this do? What would this mean? How would it change things? But there was also a lot of accusatory feeling, I guess, like, well, we know what will happen to you now that you all have this money.
Right.
Well, based on the time that you got $200 million, you know. And I think another one of the wonderful things that has happened, and I think it's had to do, I'm going to say, in a good part to having you and some of your other colleagues there, is that, yes, of course, it's enabled all kinds of things, and it's enabled the building, and it's enabled the size of prizes and so on. But here you are talking about and having discussion groups with 12 people, mm-hmm. and that's a great thing. And that did not end because you got a grant from Mrs. Lilly.
Right. No, it started. It began, in fact, because right. we have a grant from Mrs. Lilly, and we were able to give to increase the number of prizes that we give to young poets. We used to give 2 Lilly prizes. We now give 5. We give prizes for prose that weren't able to give in the past. We got all kinds of writers who are writing for us who weren't in the past because we're able to pay them. Right. So yeah, it has enabled great things for the magazine, certainly.
We're speaking with Christian Wiman, W-I-M-A-N, editor of poetry and poet and writer and critic himself, and we'll be coming to all of that. Prose is one of the things that you wanted from the beginning to have more of in the magazine. You wanted to, and you have had more criticism, letters, lively right. section, essays, things by people who might be readers of poetry but not writers of poetry
right.
talking about various things. What have you found from increasing that aspect of the magazine and what's worked? What maybe did you decide to change over these years?
Well, yeah, we wanted to draw more attention to the prose at the outset, and we tripled the size of it. The amount of poems in the magazine stayed the same, but the prose tripled. The content of the prose tripled, and that was very deliberate because you can get people's attention much more quickly with prose than you can with poetry.
Right.
And in the short term, you could even say the prose is more important because that's what creates the conversation around the magazine and gets everyone interested in the poems. In the long term, it's the poems that we publish that matter. So yeah, I found one of the things I was frustrated with when I took over the job, and it's still a frustration. It's not as if I've made it go away or anything. It's the sort of wall between the poetry world and the rest of the world. And it sort of goes both ways. You often get the sense from poets that they're writing only for other poets. And then outside of the poetry world, you often get the sense that people are afraid of poetry or don't know how to approach it. Or feel like there's no poetry being written now that is for them.
Right.
And so we wanted to make that wall more permeable in some way and to get people from outside the poetry world writing about poetry, and also to get people from inside the poetry world writing about things that people from outside might be interested in. So we've had all kinds of, people from outside, Richard Rorty, Christopher Hitchens, Patricia Barber, all these people, politicians and actors and all kinds of people write about their experience of poetry. And then we've had poets write memoiristic pieces. We've had them write about cooking. We've had them write about pets. We've had them, all kinds of crazy
right.
ideas. Some work, some don't. But the whole goal is simply to make the conversation more fluid.
And you've added art, and you've even had a cartoon issue and other kinds of artist contributions.
Right. We've had we've added visual content. The magazine didn't have that in the past, and the money makes that possible as well.
Right.
And most of those special projects are really due to one person, Fred Sasaki, at the mm-hmm. magazine. He tends to come up with the idea. The Joan Mitchell, for instance, is completely his idea. He spearheaded it, and I approved things at the end. I saw what he was doing,
right.
but really he did it. And most of those visual things, Tony Fitzpatrick, a well-known Chicago illustrator and artist, also did a portfolio for us, and Fred organized that.
You have been very good at having people who get excited and stay, whereas with reason, especially when the pay was less than existent,
yeah.
Poetry was always a great place. I know that that Joe and John Nims and their predecessors got plenty of applications, perhaps almost as many as they got poems. But they would find, and you would find, great young people, and then after a year or so, then they'd move on to something and hope to be able to show what they had done. But you've had a team that's fairly pretty much intact. I mean, you had a manager who reached retirement age, and she decided to retire. But yeah. Otherwise, you've got a group, and you've also, though, you've let them develop their projects, which is, I think, an important thing for an editor or a publisher to do.
It's been a learning experience for me because when I took over, I really had no idea how to manage anything. You know, I'd never even had a real job, honestly. And so that was quite a learning experience.
You had written poetry, you had taught.
Yeah, but sort of taught at the edges of things,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that was a learning experience, and I made some mistakes early on. And but yeah, we've had this team in place for quite a long time, and they have, I mean, I feel like they've made my life so much easier because they all have a, they do their job very well, but they all take on other things that I don't expect them to do.
Right.
And from film projects to acting to theater collaborations to Don Cher, the senior editor, goes over to England once or twice a year and does things. And so all these things are done out of their own initiative and out of enthusiasm for the magazine.
Was there anything that you found halfway through or whatever that you might have been going in a direction that maybe should be modified? Or do you think that that everything you put in place with the general tweaks and edits that go on in any project have succeeded?
One of the things I wanted to do was have very serious criticism and have people who were willing to say exactly what they did and didn't like. And I wanted large omnibus reviews, so we would sometimes review 10 books, which the magazine had done in the past. There's a wonderful review by a couple of them by Leslie Fiedler, the great critic Leslie Fiedler, called 10 Bad Books. And he just decimates them, one right after another. So this is an idea that I took from the past. I actually got a lot of ideas from the, sort of the deep past of the magazine.
That was a very important thing. I mean, a lot of people come in. I was talking to an editor of a magazine recently, and I made some mention about this historic period of this particular magazine, and the editor just looked at me absolutely blankly.
Really?
Did not know who had started the magazine, did not know who had owned the magazine or written for it. And then the person said, well, I've only been here a year and a half. And I thought, well, the first thing you do is you read the old issues of a magazine,
right? Yeah.
And you see what you like and don't like and what you can learn.
Yeah.
And that's something you did do.
Oh, yeah, I did. Well, I'd always read poetry. I mean, I had read the old issues.
Right.
Even before when I started to write for them, I did. But yeah, there were a lot of people had a lot of great ideas. Like particularly under Henry Rago, that he would do all kinds of things with the prose that we tried to. I learned from him. But yeah, those things got out of hand. I think they not out of hand. They just ran their course. I actually still believe that they were the right thing to do.
Right.
That we hired a lot of reviewers who have gone on to become, very well known, like Dan Chasen and Peter Campion and D.H. Tracy, all these people. It was very hard to find women to do that. Took a while to get them on board. Now we have great women reviewers as well.
Mm-hmm.
But we just sort of gave them free rein to do what they wanted to, and it upset a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And we would get a lot of letters and in the magazine, and it just caused a lot of controversy. I think it was quite essential. It was like a purgative. It was a purgative of the magazine, a purgative of the poetry world, a sort of clearing of the air.
Yeah.
And to see if we could create some kind of critical climate and language in which we could talk honestly about books. But if you just went on like that, I saw eventually there was a time to stop, and we stopped.
It's very interesting, and again, going back to just this very basic idea of time, and that is the reminder that you can't find out how things work if you don't try them.
Yeah.
But you also have to keep an eye on them and see. I mean, Mine weren't for publication. I mean, not because they were mean, I hope, but mine weren't for publication. But I know I was one of the people writing to you about some of those essays or some of that tone. But in retrospect, as you say, there needed to be certain things. And if you're going to be upping the place of criticism in this magazine, you need to do it in a way that various types of criticism are out there, and also to test the limits in whatever direction, whether it's of praise or of damning. And sometimes that will say more about the writer than it will about the works being written about. But how do you know unless you – it's not the same if you just show it to a couple of other people in the office. You have to get that
I think that's right.
sense from yeah. the readers. And
yeah, that's the old William Blake idea. You never know what's enough till you know what's more than enough.
Right. And then, yeah. So you're going to be exhibiting your paintings too?
That's right, yeah.
Thank you.
You've gone through many things yourself during this this time period, and you've discussed them. In fact, they drive two of your most recent works, and also your next move professionally and personally. You've got a nonfiction book coming out in April, My Bright Abyss, Meditation of a Modern Believer, from FSG, Farrar, Straus, Giroux, and you also, in your most recent book of poems from FSG, Every Riven Thing, talk about matters of faith, talk about matters of belief, talk about dealing with terminal illness, dealing with cancer, and also dealing with love and marriage and creating a family, mm-hmm. and all of these things happening at the same time.
Yeah,
I mean, you were used to juggling things because, as I recall, you were both an academic type and a sports type for a period in your life, and a tennis player, and so on. So, but this was a little heavier, of course, to juggle all of these things. And you're going to Yale to a position that probably when people from outside of that particular world read the title of the place, they wonder if you're becoming a musicologist. But Right. But it's almost as if it's a program made for Chris Wyman. It's called the Institute for Sacred Music, and it's associated with the university and with the Divinity School and with
the music department
and with the theological seminary in history. So we'll come to that in a moment, but maybe you can give us a little outline. We don't need to do a whole psychological medical analysis here, but maybe give us a little summation of the things you've been confronted with over these last recent years.
Well, yeah, I took over the job in 2003, and as I've written, I met my wife shortly after that, and I had not been writing for a long period of time. It had been 3 years, is my recollection, and no poems. And I tend to have long droughts, but that's a particularly long one, 3 years. I thought maybe it was over. And
You thought maybe
writing poetry
was over.
Yeah.
Which had been your life.
Yeah. And so what seemed from the outside to be a very exciting period for me, taking over the editorship of Poetry Magazine. In fact, it was exciting, but it wasn't that exciting to me. I was having more difficulties than I could deal with, really, in terms of not being able to write. And writing is always how I've been able to be in the world. It's how I understand the world and sort of deal with the anxiety that the world causes, that existence causes. And so when that was taken away, I fell into despair for a while, and then I met Danielle and fell in love in 2000. Gosh, I mean, it was like a week after I took over Poetry Magazine.
And that's Danielle Chapman, who is herself a wonderful writer. Once you had a conflict of interest there, you lost one of your better women critics when you're trying to build up women criticism. And then she's also held various jobs with the Literary Arts Department of Cultural Affairs and other things in the city. Mm-hmm. So you met her then, and
right, and then we got married a year after we met, and then shortly after that, I got a diagnosis of very rare lymphoma, very rare and complicated lymphoma, and you can imagine the effect that had. That was catastrophic at the time, and.
You were in your late 30s when that happened.
Yeah, I was
right?
39.
39.
I was 39. And it certainly, as with most people, it you know, a diagnosis like that will cause you to rethink your life, to think about your ultimate concern, as Paul Tillich puts it. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of resistant to thinking of that diagnosis causing a return to faith, because in fact it was more that meeting Danielle caused both of us to begin wanting to go to church, wanting to pray. We started to pray together.
And it was something spontaneous almost,
yeah,
right?
It wasn't like... Yeah, it was something...
One of you was pulling the other or something. It was
not
something
at all.
that entered into your relationship.
Yeah, and hadn't been there until really we got married. And then once I got sick, I needed to give some form to faith. And I mean, it's fine to have a kind of inchoate feeling of faith, and I think most people go through life like that. And then something happens to you, and if you don't have a form for it, it's very difficult for it to mean anything at all in your life. And I needed to give it a form. And so I never think of somehow having a conversion. I never felt like a conversion. Nothing ever changed in that regard. I felt like I was assenting to something that had just long been latent within me.
You were raised as a Christian.
I was Southern Baptist, fundamentalist. Really.
And you're from West Texas.
From West Texas, yeah. And I shortly after that, I started to write again. Really, right after we started going to church, I wrote two poems in quick succession, almost on. Maybe even on successive days, and after not having written in 3 years.
Yeah, that's something.
Yeah, and then they started coming again. And
how had they changed, or had they changed?
Well, I'd like to think that they're more open, more ventilated with life, maybe is a way of putting it, or more open to certain areas of life that I wasn't in the past. In the past, I could only feel like I've never written anything but religious poetry in all my books. It's just that I didn't know what I was doing until very recently. But I hope that for years I was only able to feel a kind of energy from absence, or not having something. I didn't know what that something was. And I hope that now the poems are more capable of expressing ordinary joy and happiness and a sense of fulfillment. There's still a good deal of anguish, but I hope that they are open to other emotions.
I can hear some people listening to the program right now and thinking or saying aloud, what religious poetry? So, I mean, is he writing My Daily Word? Is he writing Hallmark? And as you're saying, looking back at your own poetry and seeing that it was religious poetry, one, of course, there is a great tradition. We think of Hopkins. We think of Blake. But there's also, I think, what you're also pointing us to is that there's a sacredness to poetry, period. And certainly you look at I would say two of the most basic examples of people who were not overtly writing about religion, but William Carlos Williams, Wallace Stevens. I mean, you can't read these poems without thinking that they're about life and creation and death and love.
Wallace Stevens seems to be a religious poet.
Right.
I mean, he seems to be. I mean, he's renouncing religion in a lot of his poems, but with the music of religious poetry behind it, he seems to me a classically religious poet.
Yeah, I guess I just wanted to get that out there.
Yeah.
That by religious poetry, I don't think you would mind if your poems caused people to think about their own faith and move in some direction there. But your purpose is to remind us that poetry is a part of that side of our humanity.
There's a great, I think suddenly, of this quote from Anna Kamienska, the Polish poet. She's not well known, but we published some of her diaries in the magazine. Claire Kavanaugh at Northwestern has translated three big sections for the magazine. And she has a little section in one of her diaries where she says about the poet Piotrek, another Polish poet that nobody knows. says, you know, Piatak got down on his knees and thanked God after every poem he wrote, and Piatak was an atheist.
Right.
And I think that's a pretty good pretty good illustration of most poets' inner lives right there.
Right. Studs Terkel, towards the end of his very long and very rich life, started talking about things like this. And Studs was, you know, Izzy Stone, who I wrote a book about, referred to himself as a pious Jewish atheist. But Studs would say, you know, I was an atheist for 80 years. Now I'm an agnostic. You know what an agnostic is? It's a cowardly atheist, or it's an atheist who's turned 90. You know? But these are the same kind of points, maybe from the Jewish side of the ledger. But that, you know, sure, even if we are militantly non-church or synagogue or mosque-going, if we're engaged in our own lives and if we're engaged in the life outside of us, we're engaged in something that can be called religion.
And how do you integrate moments of sacred experience into your lives? I think everyone is faced with this. And in fact, when I got my diagnosis, you sent me an email that you mentioned Abraham Joshua Heschel. And I had never read Heschel at the time. I've since read tons of Heschel. And I'm very grateful to you for that because, you know, one of the things that Heschel says, which I found very useful, is he says faithfulness is mostly being faithful to a time when we had faith. That most of the time, none of us has any faith. We're all atheists most of the time.
Right.
And he says, and yet we all have these moments in our lives where we are lifted out of ourselves and we feel ourselves having faith in something beyond ourselves. And Heschel says, how do you live up to those moments? Well, you remain faithful to those moments when you had faith. It's a discipline of memory in a way, but not simply memory. It has a future to it as well.
We also see within religion that idea of faith of our fathers, faith of our grandparents, very important. And that's sometimes an entryway, isn't it, where we think, gosh, I don't really follow this or I don't go for this, but my wonderful grandfather passed this on or this was a part of his thing or my grandmother had a wisdom that I think I need to tap into again.
Yeah, well, there's a great ending to that Philip Larkin poem. You talk about a poet who's gone one step further than Wallace Stevens. For him, he was an atheist.
Right.
He still seems to be a religious poet, but
right.
But he was certainly an atheist. And in that poem Church Going, he has a guy walking into a church in England, and you know the church in England, nobody goes to church in England, and he walks in this empty church and wonders, you know, who's going to be there in the future? What are these places even going to be for? And he imagines in the end that somebody will always return to this, if only that so many dead lie round. And so it's just that idea that you're talking about. It's somehow these parts of our lives acquire a sacred meaning because of all the lives that have been poured into them and suffering that has been poured into them.
And interesting, too, you go back to some of the overtly or day-to-day religious poets who wrote about these subjects, and yet they wrote poems that moved people into a more secular direction. Thomas Gray, John Donne. Not saying that you can't find their religion there, but these became great humanistic touchstones, including going into country churchyards.
Yeah, that's a great
and
point.
Looking at the dead.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is to me, and I think probably among many other things to you, one of the great things about poetry is it takes us places and it makes us think both with our heads and our insides. And one person that may lead him or her to become a minister and a priest, or another, it might lead to become a collector of model trains. But it's going to, it can transform you or confirm something in you. Yeah.
I think so. I think, and there's that idea of, I think one of the things you're getting at when you question the notion of religious poetry or try to expand the notion of religious poetry is, you know, poetry can't just be some expression of an idea or belief that you have. It has to always test that. There has to always be some risk in what you're writing. And Ezra Pound said famously, "How can I know what I think until I see what I've said?"
Yeah.
And Frost, in a different way, said, Robert Frost said, you know, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. And the sense there is that if your work isn't causing you to become disoriented and causing some real vertigo in you, you're not going to get to some place where, of surprise. And I think often in my work, what I find is, at first what surprised me in some of the poems was that I believed. I wrote these poems in which I believed. If you'd asked me, you know, do you believe in God? I would have said no. Mm-hmm. And then I wrote poems in which I did. And
interesting.
And so it was some kind of moment of grace given to me in my work. Jeffrey Hill has a beautiful, haunting phrase in one of his prose about certain writers who are unable ever to trust the moments of grace that they're given in their work, and he's one.
Jeffrey with a G-E-O.
Right.
One of the most, when people say there are no more great poets or no more great writers, they haven't read Jeffrey Hill, I don't think. I mean, he's almost too great. Sometimes you need a dictionary.
You definitely need a dictionary, yeah.
Of thesaurus and everything else, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe this is a good moment to read a poem.
Sure.
Would you mind?
Sure.
And this isn't a setup such as you have on some other radio programs where the poem has been selected and then I pretend to say, would you like to read a poem? But I'm actually watching Christian look through his poetry book and see from every riven thing if there might be something appropriate.
So let me read two poems here together. And one is one of the poems, the first poem that I wrote after that long drought that I just mentioned. And it's the title poem of this book. It's called Every Riven Thing. And I wrote this just in one sitting, and it has a complicated rhyme scheme, which you don't need to know about, but it was shocking for me to manage this in such a short time. It uses one line, God goes belonging to every riven thing he's made, and then it changes the punctuation each time that line recurs, and it happens five times, so that it changes the meaning. Riven means broken or split. God goes, belonging to every riven thing he's made, sing his being simply by being the thing it is. Stone and tree and sky, man who sees and sings and wonders why, God goes. Belonging to every riven thing he's made means a storm of peace. Think of the atoms inside the stone. Think of the man who sits alone, trying to will himself into a stillness where God goes belonging. To every riven thing he's made, there is given one shade, shaped exactly to the thing itself. Under the tree, a darker tree. Under the man, the only man to see, God goes belonging to every riven thing. He's made the things that bring him near, made the mind that makes him go. A part of what man knows, apart from what man knows, God goes belonging to every riven thing he's made. Mm. And so that poem really surprised me. Because, as I say, I would have thought of myself as someone who was not capable of belief, and then mm-hmm. that poem expresses a belief. And not just a belief, but a very sort of fluent, coherent belief. It's not specifically Christian. You could put that
right.
belief into all kinds of different religions.
You have that, not the idea of the thing, but the thing itself side in there, but the thing itself is also God or about God and his interference, involvement.
Yeah, yeah. There's a great quote from Meister Eckhart, the Christian mystic. The eye with which I see God is the eye with which God sees me.
Mm-hmm.
And a notion that there is some sort of reciprocity of attention.
Right.
The attention we pay to the world is being paid back to us. The world gazes back into us. You can also think of Nietzsche that when you gaze long into the abyss also gazes long into you. So it's not so.
Right.
It's a more ominous note
yes,
there.
Yes, yes. And you had a companion for that poem, you said.
Well, I was surprised. I was very happy to begin writing poems again. And I wrote some that did seem to me expressions of faith that were really helpful to me, that bolstered me, and seemed like moments of grace to me. And I say that quite apart from the quality of the poem. I'm not offering the poems up as, you know, in one way or another. I think people can have, you can have these moments of grace in your art, whatever the result is. I mean, that's the great, that's the saving grace of art, so to speak, is that it's not contingent upon the success of the work of art so much. You know, that's why poetry can be accessed by so many people.
Mm-hmm.
But then I wrote a lot of poems, not a lot, but some, that seemed to me to repudiate everything that I had that I had learned. And here's one called Hammer is the Prayer. There is no consolation in the thought of God, he said, slamming another nail in another house another havoc had half taken. Grace is not consciousness, nor is it beyond. To hell with remembrance, to hell with heaven. Hammer is the prayer of the poor and the dying. And as wind in some lordless random comes to rest, and all the disquieted dust within, peace came to the hinterlands of our minds, too remote to know, but peace nonetheless.
It's almost a response to
the previous poem. Yeah, damned if I know what to make of them, but I just write them.
We're talking with Christian Wyman, Chris Wyman, W-I-M-A-N, reading to us there from his most recent book of poems, available in both hardcover and paperback from Farrar Straus, Every Riven, R-I-V-E-N, Every Riven Thing. And we're going to have to keep this conversation going in another program because we're running out of time. We're going to bring you a consecutive part two. I do want to say, though, so that you're not kept in suspense, that while Chris has had serious hospitalizations and bone marrow transplants and deals with chemo and these kinds of things all the time, and his future is unknown, but the future of each of us is pretty unknown, he's doing fine now, and he and his wife have a pair of rambunctious 3-year-old twins.
We do. Yeah.
And he's going to be going off to start a 5-year term with the Institute for Sacred Music at Yale University and also be involved with the Yale Divinity School. And you'll hear more about all of that next week in part two. Chris Wyman, thank you so much for talking with us, sharing poems, sharing ideas, and sharing your life with us.
Thanks for having me, Andrew. Thank you.
Music we heard this evening from the Takacs Quartet, a favorite group of Chris Wyman's and of mine as well, recorded 7 years ago in Bristol, May 2006, on the Hyperion label. We heard the Andante and the Allegro Moderato movements of the 13th string quartet of Schubert, A minor, D804 from that year of 1824, and we all know this as the Rosamunda Quartet. I'd like to thank Chris Wyman, Danielle Chapman, Kristen Gierken of the Poetry Foundation, the folks at Farrar, Straus, Giroux, Matt DeStefano for recording the program and making it sound great. Our funders, Alphawood Foundation, Dick and Susie Kiphart, and other friends of this program. Let us know what you thought about this or any of our other programs. Drop us a line at RENTAP. It's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com. Go to the WFMT Facebook page. Go to the WFMT.com page and chime in. Go to WFMT.com/critical thinking, where you can experience the always free and we hope always interesting Critical Thinking podcast. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll have more with Chris Wyman next week.